Next up is Adam Colbert, who's an old friend of ours from law professor at the University of San Diego, who's been out of town for a while at Princeton Center for Human Values on a Rockefeller Fellowship. And Adam also runs the very informative Neuroethics and Law blog, which I invite you to read.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Roger. When I was here last year, I spoke about the possible use of brain imaging to tell us something about pain and how much pain people were in. And I pointed to some fMRI studies that tell us something about acute pain conditions, to some structural brain studies that tell us something about chronic back pain. And this is really interesting to lawyers, right? Because we want to know if people are faking their conditions and that sort of thing. And the basic idea here is, how can we get more objective measurements of subjective experience, like pain, right? It's a private experience. And so today I'm going to talk about the similar topic on a broader way, and it's going to have both more immediate consequences and some more futuristic consequences. In particular, I'm going to talk about emotional pain and how can we measure better the amount of emotional pain that we purposely or knowingly inflict on prisoners. And so let me give you an example, and I want you to imagine two people. One is named Sensitive and one is named Insensitive. And they both commit some crime and they're both equally blameworthy, and they both get the same, say, 4-year sentence in prison, identical prison. So everything I've told you so far about Sensitive and Insensitive, it's exactly the same. Here's the difference. Sensitive finds his life in prison unbearable. He's can hardly sleep. He wakes up in the middle of the night. He's sweating. He's constantly in a state of panic at some level. Whereas Insensitive doesn't like prison, but he's able to bear it, and he kind of gets through it, and it's not so bad for Insensitive comparatively. Now, generally speaking, we don't consider these sorts of differences in prisoners. We have something of a duration fetish, right? We just focus on the amount of time that you're sentenced to prison. And this actually connects a little bit with what Philip Zimbardo was talking about. He was speaking of time perspective, not so much the experience of time passing, but it won't surprise you at all to know that time may be experienced in different ways for different people. And that's just the time factor, right? There's so many other variables in prison in terms of closed-in spaces, being away from your family, et cetera, that are going to vary a lot from person to person. It's possible that judges do take these kinds of things into consideration, but if they do, it's sub rosa. We don't know about it. It's not part of formal sentencing guidelines. And in fact, people often tend to criticize the possibility that judges are going to be doing this. If they are doing it, we can't review it on appeal. There might be bias going on that we don't see. So I kind of want to bring this issue to light a little bit. And one of the more appealing cases where you might think we should take kind of subjective experience into account is claustrophobia. So that's possibly one case where people are going to be sympathetic to the notion that the way you experience your sentence is pertinent to how severe it is. So what could science possibly tell us? Well, if you want to be a little bit futuristic about it, we have some inklings of neuroscience telling us something about people who have long-term stress or long-term depression have certain structural changes in their brain. There are other biological markers of stress, particularly acute stress, so things like hormone levels and urine samples that can tell you something about acute distress. And maybe acute distress could tell us something about chronic distress. But certainly, traditional psychology has a lot to say about this topic. So for a very long time, psychologists have sought to measure depression. And even though people have incentives to lie, psychologists have developed methods to try to determine when people are lying. So as difficult as this might seem, there's a very clear example of where we do try to take subjective experience into account, and that's in the tort context. By tort, I mean civil litigation. So if you're in a car accident and someone breaks your arm in a crash of some sort, you're entitled to damages for that. But we don't simply attach a price tag to a broken arm or to a broken leg. We don't say $10,000 for a broken leg and $5,000 for a broken arm. We actually try to determine the subjective level of pain or distress that you're in as a result of the condition. There's also a tort of false imprisonment. So someone has confined you against your will. If that happens, we don't say, oh, okay, well, it's $200 per hour of confinement. We actually try to measure the distress of being confined. And so it's not impossible to do this in the case of prison either. It's just very difficult. But when I get to my candle, you'll see why it's important to understand severity properly, even in advance of the technology to do so. So far I've been speaking about the concept of punishment severity. Why does this matter? It depends a bit on what you think punishment is all about. There are two sort of major theories of why we punish people. The first is a retributive notion, the idea that punishment severity should be proportional to your blameworthiness, that you've done something wrong, that you deserve punishment, that you deserve to suffer in some respect. So if you look at that in the sensitive and insensitive context, then it seems to me you have reasons to actually calibrate their sentences based on their experiences if you think it's about giving sensitive the amount of suffering he deserves and insensitive the amount of suffering he deserves. But there's another view about punishment, and this is a more consequentialist notion of punishment. We seek to incapacitate dangerous people, we seek to deter people from engaging in crime, and we seek to rehabilitate prisoners. If you think that punishment is just about incapacitation, then subjective experience isn't particularly relevant, right? We gain incapacitation regardless of how you experience that time. But deterrence might be relevant to subjective experience, at least anticipated subjective experience. But more importantly, consequentialists have to worry about subjective experience because when they do a kind of weighing between the costs and the benefits of punishing someone, you have to consider the costs. And one of those costs is the subjective experience of being in prison. So if you buy into the Sam Harris, let's maximize well-being, this is basically the same thing, which is on the flip side. How do we minimize the opposite of well-being? And so I think you clearly want to consider these feelings. Imagine if we had a sadistic warden. And the warden discovers, oh, there's been something, some chemical put in the prison water supply, and it makes some prisoners more anxious than others, some more distressed than others. And the warden can stop this very easily, but he decides, you know what, no, I'm not going to do that. I think we have grounds for criticizing the warden because he has, in some sense, knowingly caused substantial distress without justification for it. So you may have, now I just also add, in the consequentialist framework, it's not clear that you need to punish people proportionally. So with sensitive and insensitive, the retributivist, proportional retributivist says you have to try to calibrate their sentences. The consequentialist maybe doesn't need to calibrate individually, but needs to kind of engage in the broader consequentialist calculus that includes considering things like the negative subjective experience of punishment. So you probably have a couple of objections sort of swirling through your mind, a couple of alarm bells going off. Suppose you think that punishment is about giving people proportionally what they deserve, a kind of retributive notion, and you say, you know what, I don't feel so bad about sensitive and insensitive. Sensitive should have realized that he's sensitive to punishment. Nevertheless, he engaged in the crime. Tough luck. But this is probably not a kind of proportionality that you're satisfied with, principle proportionality that you're satisfied with in general. So imagine if we punish left-handed people with 2 years in prison and right-handed people with 20 years in prison when they commit the same crime. The lefties and the righties may have advance notice of what punishment they may face, but we still tend to think of that as a disproportional punishment. Even if you're less concerned about the disproportionality, it's still disproportional. Second kind of a concern that's probably going through your mind is I sort of call the Paris Hilton objection, right? So someone like Paris Hilton used to find homes, find food, is probably going to have a tougher time in prison than ordinary guy who commits the same, let's say, drunk driving offense. But this tends to conflict with our intuitions because most of you probably think that Paris Hilton should spend at least as much time as regular Joe when they both commit the same crime. So there's a little bit of a puzzle here. And I find it intriguing because often we don't have a general egalitarian notion about society in general. But somehow at the point of sentencing, this egalitarian notion seems to kick in where we seem to think, no, we have to make her situation in prison equal to the regular guy's sentence in prison. So I think it's intriguing. Now, one possibility is that we actually think that maybe Paris Hilton is more blameworthy when she commits the same crime as this ordinary guy, right? She could have had a chauffeur take her home from a party if she was drunk. She had all these other opportunities. and nevertheless she committed the same crime. So if that's the case, if in some sense you think she's more blameworthy when she commits the same crime, then the puzzle may go away at least a little bit, right? That explains why you think she should suffer more by spending the same amount of time in prison. But that might not be your view. Maybe you don't think that she's more blameworthy, and maybe you're just not a proportionalist about punishment. So I think the example doesn't show that subjective experience is irrelevant. It may just show that you're not a proportionalist about punishment. So what are the more futuristic applications of this possibility? Well, suppose we really could accurately measure something like the opposite of well-being associated with punishment. Well, then it seems like there would be consequentialist reasons for measuring the ongoing negative well-being of prisoners. Or if you think that punishment is about retribution, then again, you still want to monitor how much suffering you're knowingly or purposely causing them. It's interesting because I think this has a kind of 1984-ish feeling that makes people squeamish. And it's puzzling because when we're talking about prison, we're talking about purposely or knowingly inflicting something that people really don't like. And people are okay with that. I don't mind that you're confining someone against their will. I don't mind that you're causing them distress, but they get very troubled with the notion that you want to measure the amount of distress that you're causing them. So I find that puzzling. But that's the futuristic side. What's the more immediate side? The more immediate side is, yes, we probably can't do this very practically on an individual basis, but we could certainly craft policies that are more subjectively sensitive than the ones we had now. So yesterday, we heard Sonia speaking about the concept of hedonic adaptation, the idea that after a period of time, people who are, let's say, having negative affect will tend to revert a little bit closer back to their ordinary baseline affect. And so this tends to mean, and I know that Owen Flanagan points to some of this data in his recent book, it tends to mean that prisoners have the toughest time at the beginning. And then as their sentences go on and on, they tend to adapt to it to some degree. You need to take that into consideration when you're thinking about the duration of prison sentences. Similarly, recidivist punishments. We tend to punish repeat offenders more severely than first-time offenders. And often that's explained in terms of blameworthiness. People think the repeat offender is more blameworthy and deserves a more severe sentence. If you only think of it that way, you're missing out on an entire access of punishment. Namely, not only may he or she be more blameworthy or not, but they may also have need more punishment in order to get, let's say, the same deterrent effect or the same level of negative affect in prison. That's one area, taking account of hedonic adaptation. Another area, the punishment system separates out sentencers from the people who administer punishments. So typically, the judge passes the sentence, and then bureaucrats pick the facility that you go to. So it would be very difficult for judges to even know what kind of facility you're going to be in because we cause this separation. And so there are some policies that we could make that would bring these back together again. So there's a lot more that we could say about that, but let me just cut to the candle in the dark here. Historically, we've treated prison sentences as equal if they have the same duration. And I think we do this at least in part because of the difficulty in actually trying to measure subjective experience. We've lacked the psychological and technological abilities to do otherwise. But we shouldn't let our own current technological limitations alter the way that we think about the severity of punishment. For even with these kinds of technological limitations that we have now, we can still craft broad policies that better reflect what we know about the mind and the brain. Thanks very much.